History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull were two Lakota chiefs who grew up on the high plains of the American West, and they were part of the final generation that were born and raised in a way similar to their ancestors. They followed vast herds of buffalo that seemed to cover the earth, and their people could move around freely in a nomadic style and lord over their fighting prowess over rival tribes. But neither man had known a time without whites. They met fur traders and government explorers that were the first to penetrate Sioux lands, and then later, travelers on the Oregon-California Trail, then gold seekers and railroad men and settlers and town builders. Over time, the buffalo population plummeted, disease from these settlers spread, which decimated villages, and conflicts with the interlopers increased. But what triggered irreversible conflict between the Great Sioux Nation and white settlers was the 1874 military expedition of George Armstrong Custer. He announced that there was gold in the Black Hills, which triggered the Black Hills Gold Rush. Citizens increasingly pressured the U.S. government to open the Black Hills to mining and settlement. The government heard this, but they had to find a way around the promise to protect the Sioux in their land, as specified in an earlier treaty. In 1875, President Grant ordered all Sioux Indians outside the Great Sioux Reservation to move on the reservation, otherwise they would be considered hostiles. All of this triggered the 1876 Battle of the Little Big Horn, which saw Custer's last stand. Now, in this episode, we're not going to talk about this famous battle. Instead, we're going to look at the lives of Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull, up to and including this battle and what came after. I'm joined with guest Mark Lee Gardner, author of the book The Earth is All That Lasts, Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, and the Last Stand of the Great Sioux Nation. The Battle of the Little Big Horn was the Sioux Nation's greatest victory, but it was also the beginning of the end for their way of life. And in the years to come, both Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull would meet violent and similar fates. But this isn't just a story of tragedy, this is also a story of two fascinating leaders and how they struggled to maintain the freedom of their people, and in some ways succeeded, against impossible odds when they were facing an adversary that had overwhelming technological, military, and resource superiority. This is an important chapter in American history, and it's worth exploring in detail. I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Mark Lee Gardner. Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull were born and grew into manhood on the high plains of the American West, and although neither of them knew a time without whites, they perhaps lived in the final period in their people's history where they could still experience a boyhood and a young adulthood similar to their ancestors, where buffalo covered the earth, their tribes could roam freely. But by the end of their lives, the settlement of the West had largely ended, especially for Sitting Bull. And the changes that they saw were larger than perhaps any person would ever experience, where from a young adult, they lived according to tribal customs that could somewhat resemble those of a Neolithic tribe in Eurasia. And by the end, they were trained to assimilate into 19th century American life. So could you give us a scope of the change that they saw from the early 1800s to the late 1800s?
Well, I write in the book that Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse were born into a buffalo culture, and their people followed the buffalo herds. The buffalo herds fed them, provided them their clothing, their shelter, and it provided them with wealth. They used the Lakota women tanned the buffalo hides, which were not only used for themselves, but also was trade. And as you mentioned, you know, they didn't know a time without whites, but most of the whites that they knew, say, at the time Sitting Bull was born in 1831, those were traders or explorers. And the traders were especially critical because that's how they acquired manufactured items, whether it was, you know, pots and pans, flints for guns, and you know, weapons themselves, metal for arrowheads. But it was an interesting dynamic because at that time, they were completely free. They experienced free will. They moved wherever they want. And generally that was, again, following the herds. But also at the same time, they needed those trade connections. They, you know, they were already born into a world market economy. And had it stayed at that, both Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse would have been extremely happy in their people. That balance that existed, or somewhat of a balance in the 1830s and 40s, allowed them to remain free and allowed them to remain in control of their lands. But as time went on, it wasn't just traders and explorers and government officials. You know, soon you had immigrants crossing their lands. They're killing buffalo. You have railroads expanding westward. You have the American government, which is wanting to shrink the size of Indian lands in the West and eventually force them upon reservations. And what ultimately happens with the Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull, they grow from a period of ultimate freedom and free will to living by the forced dictates of their conquerors, the U.S. government. Sitting Bull didn't have to live long under those situations. Sitting Bull had a few years, but their lives ultimately ended violently in the same way, and mostly because they resisted.
Things do change from the 1840s onward, as you mentioned, before their sparsely populated territories. But then was gold is discovered in 1848 in the Sierra Nevada, and many people are interested in the potential for gold mining in the Black Hills. The government is trying to negotiate the settlement, but they realize ultimately they can't force people to stay out of Indian territory. They also can't force American Indians onto reservations. And it's an inoperable status quo. And the two men in your book are trying to navigate these tumultuous decades in different ways. First, can you describe to me Sitting Bull's life on the High Plains and his refusal to allow any independent or dependence on the U.S. government and what it looked like over these decades?
Well, I think it's important with Sitting Bull when you look at his life, and this was something that I wasn't as aware of when I started researching his life. I mean, we all think of Sitting Bull as the great holy man and leader of the anti-treaty bands of the Lakotas, but he started out his career as a great and admired warrior who counted many coups, and one doesn't, and you know, he wasn't a hereditary chief. His father wasn't a chief. There were many leaders among the Lakotas who gained that status through their father, but that wasn't Sitting Bull. He earned his status, much like Crazy Horse, on the battlefield and gathered his followers that way. So the first thing to know about Sitting Bull in his early life was that he was a great warrior. And like many warriors, he kept track of his coups and painted multiple drawings of his different battlefield heroics. But he also attained the status of a holy man, which was a whole separate thing or class and required, you know, specific training from other holy men, the knowledge of various rituals within Lakota religion. He was an incredible sun dancer. And the sun dance is where you make an offering either through cutting pieces of your skin. You make an offering to Wakantanka, you know, the great spirit, and sacrificing pieces of your skin, or as you've seen probably in depictions or drawings or movies, being tethered to a long rawhide rope tied to a pole and staring below the sun and until you break free from those tethers. And you're doing this, often the sun dance is a thank you for perhaps Wakantanka saving you during some very difficult or brush with death, or asking for food. So there are many reasons for the sun dance, but Sitting Bull was born into that culture and the warrior culture, I guess you might say, but a buffalo culture. And as time went on, he rose in the ranks of leadership to where not only was he first a war chief, but eventually by the late 60s, he had been elected as, quote, the supreme leader of those bands that refused to abide by or sign a treaty with the U.S. government.
Going onward, before his famous confrontation with Custer in 1876, can you describe what he did during Red Cloud's War? This is in the 1860s, and it shows his development as a leader here and the nature of his conflict with the U.S. government.
Well, Sitting Bull wasn't really involved in the Red Cloud War, not like Crazy Horse. Sitting Bull, and you have different fronts to these encroachments upon the Northern Plains. So Sitting Bull is mostly with his people on the Upper Missouri, and they're fighting a similar set of forts along the upper Missouri, which were established to protect travelers along the Missouri River, a lot of them who were going to the gold fields in Montana, and particularly places like Fort Buford. That was a fort that Sitting Bull was very opposed to. But all forts along the river, he wanted abandoned. Red Cloud War was a similar thing, in that these posts, though, were along land route, called the Bozeman Cutoff. So forts like Fort Reno, Fort C.S. Smith, Fort Kearney. So Sitting Bull's people weren't really active along the Bozeman Cutoff. Most of their fighting was going to be on the upper Missouri, but it's going on at the same time. It's essentially two fronts that the Lakotas are fighting on the Northern Plains.
Moving to Crazy Horse's life, he is also dealing with the conflict of encroachment of the U.S. government and settlers, but his life is different. Can you tell me about him?
Yeah, Crazy Horse was fascinating in his own time, and he's especially fascinating now. One early author, one biographer called him the strange man of the Oglalas, and he was very different, not only physically, but in his personality. So physically, he had light hair. Some who knew Crazy Horse, he said he was light-skinned. In fact, both contemporaries, both whites and Indians, thought that he looked like he had mixed parentage or was a mixed blood. And there were rumors that perhaps his mother had a liaison with the white man, but he had a different look. And even the way he dressed for battle, he was told by his holy man, Hornchips, never to wear a war bonnet. So he didn't. He wore a single feather and no other clothing but a breech clout. And then he painted his body as he was instructed, by his medicine man or holy man. He wore a charm or stone. So he wasn't this flamboyant looking leader that you often see depicted as a war chief. But as far as his personality, he didn't like to talk. He was very reserved and you might even say shy. And unfortunately, with his interactions later, when he finally was forced to surrender, the white men, the agents thought he was, they had derogatory terms that he was standoffish and moody and glum and uncooperative. But he had always had these traits, this shyness, this modesty, since he was a very young man. But these were unusual, even with the Lakotas. I mean, this was something that was remembered about him. And as I write in the book, probably the greatest display of emotion he ever showed was on the battlefield. And indeed, he was the ultimate warrior. He'd had several horses shot out from under him. I mean, he was absolutely fearless. Some might say he seemed to be a suicidal in the way he tempted fate. And again, he was not a hereditary chief. He rose up through the ranks through his deeds and through his abilities to lead others. People wanted to follow Crazy Horse because he was so successful and he was so incredible, just an amazing individual. And it's a shame we know as little as we do about him. So he definitely, I think, stands out as the more intriguing of the two individuals in the book.
I'd like to hear more about his battles in the 1850s and 1860s, the Battle of the Hundred of the Hand, the Wagon Box Fight. Particularly, what makes an American Indian warrior successful in this time period? I'm sure it's a number of factors, and you cited some: his personal bravery, his ability to lead. Are there other tactics or strategies that could make them effective against a cavalry or other American Indian tribe? So can you describe the battles and what in particular made him successful?
Sure. It took both Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull. I mean, they had to learn strategies to fight U.S. troops, blue coats, long knives. Long knives are the cavalry troopers. And, certainly the U.S. troops had, advanced weapons that weren't at first accessible to Crazy Horse's and Sitting Bull's warriors. Eventually they were, but at first they weren't. But for instance, you mentioned the Hundred in Hand. That's also known as the Fetterman Massacre because of the officer in charge of the 81 men that were annihilated by the Lakotas and the Cheyennes. But one of the techniques that the Lakotas developed, they learned very quickly not to I mean, they didn't do all-out assaults on a military fort or post, because generally they had artillery. They had howitzers. They were known as the gun that shoots twice, because it was the exploding shell. First, there's the boom from the mouth of the cannon, and then the explosion of the shot and shrapnel that rained down upon warriors at a distance. So they learned pretty quickly that, you know, it's a bad idea to try any kind of an all-out assault. So one of their favorite techniques was the decoy and then leading in, you know, the soldiers into an ambush. And they weren't always that successful. In fact, they were pretty rarely successful. But the very best, finest example of the decoy and ambush was the 100 in the Hand. And Crazy Horse was among the handful of decoys that were sent out to lure Fetterman and his men from Fort Phil Kearny on Piney Creek in present-day Wyoming over Lodge Trail Ridge. And Fetterman, you know, you can go on and on about the Fetterman himself, but, you know, he had been instructed by the commanding officer at Fort Phil Kearny, Colonel Carrington, not to take his men over Lodge Trail Ridge. I mean, they knew about these techniques. You know, they knew that the Indians loved to separate small groups of soldiers, and that was their best chance at obtaining casualties and taking scalps. But in this particular case, you know, the troops sent out, these 81 men continued to follow the decoys over Lodge Trail Ridge, where waited maybe as many as 2,000 warriors. And, you know, like other battles on the frontier, the white soldiers made many mistakes. In fact, the cavalry got far in advance of the infantry, and they were annihilated first. And then the infantry was annihilated. And then as far as tactics, one of the things that was a disadvantage for the troops under Fetterman was that the infantry was still using muzzle-loading weapons. And so there was a delay. There's a time to reload. And, you know, the Lakotas are very savvy. They know about this. And if there's a volley, they know they can charge in quickly. So it didn't take long at the 100 in the Hand to, annihilate Fetterman and his men. Now, as I said, these ambush decoy tactics, they didn't always work, but in this case, it was just like the perfect trap. And, you know, Crazy Horse, his warriors, Red Cloud, were the victors.
Just as a quick question for the weapons enthusiasts out there, when are revolvers or Winchester repeating rifles introduced to battles with the Plains Indians among U.S. troops? I know that in the South, with the Texas Rangers fighting Comanches, the Samuel Colt's six-shooter was the game changer there. In the North, when do these repeating fire weapons first appear?
Well, interestingly enough, just less than a year after the Fetterman fight is the Wagon Box fight. And at that time, the troops had just been issued these breech-loading rifles. So they're actually using cartridge weapons. And that was a real turning point in this fight, because at the Wagon Box fight, there were only like 32 men in these within this corral made of wagon boxes that are set on the ground. But they were able to hold off multiple charges by several hundred warriors. And again, it's because they were able to reload. And even with the Fetterman fight, there were some individual citizens who had repeating, I believe they were Spencer carbines with them. But, it, you know, there was just a handful of those. So those get introduced fairly quickly in the American West as the technology develops. And certainly, by 1876, Custer's men are armed with trapdoors. You know, they're called trapdoor Springfields because of the mechanism, the breech loading. But they also had the model 1873 single action Army Colt, you know, which took cartridges. And it's a revolver as well. And almost as soon as troops get some of these cartridge weapons, we see warriors obtaining them as well. And in fact, at the Battle of Little Bighorn, there were many warriors that had Winchester and Henry. Henry was the predecessor to the Winchester repeating weapons. And this is kind of a cool point. And not many people know this, and I didn't know this until I started researching. But, you know, it's one thing to have the weapons. It's another thing to have ammunition, right? And the ammunition is not that always easy to obtain unless, it's acquired in an attack or stolen. But Lakotas actually learned how to reload their shell casings. And I didn't know that before. So, sometimes they found in the camps that were attacked and taken large quantities of powder. And now some of this was used because they still were using muzzleloading weapons too, the trade guns. But they were also figuring out how to, actually reload cartridges and reuse these, in their fights with the long knives.
Now, as we're telling this story, it's difficult not to get sucked into a narrative that has a sense of inevitability, that as the frontiers continually push west, there's attrition among American Indians. And as weapons technology improves among the U.S. military, even though tribes have access to some of these weapons as well, the disparity grows and grows and grows. And there's inevitability up until the Battle of Wounded Knee, and then the frontier is closed. And for our purposes, that's the end of the story. To avoid getting pulled into that narrative, from the perspective of Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull in these decades, and we'll go from the 1850s or so up until the Battle of Little Big Horn, what did they observe was happening? Were they fighting a continual battle? Did they get a sense that things were turning against them? What's their perspective?
Well, I think one of the main perspectives is this whole business of treaties. Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse never signed a treaty, and they saw what happened when these treaties were signed, because almost always were they losing land. And another problem with treaties was that often what the interpreters told the Lakota chiefs and headmen was in the treaty ended up being a misunderstanding. Red Cloud, when he got to Washington after signing the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868, when the terms were explained to him again, he became enraged. He said, "That's not what I was told." That's the problem with these working with different languages and a contract, that you're being told a certain thing, but it's getting jarbled in the telling. And so Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, in fact, Crazy Horse called the Fort Laramie Treaty false papers. They learned very quickly that if you sign anything, it's not good. And so they refused to sign treaties. In fact, Crazy, and I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, but Crazy Horses was so afraid and against signing things that even when they asked him at the Red Cloud Agency after he had surrendered, to sign for, food. I mean, his people, it's like, what are we giving up by signing? They were just terrified of putting their city, they call it touching the pin. So they were very wary any agreements with the white man, because they saw that essentially in their eyes, the white man could not be trusted. And as both Sitting Bull and Red Cloud and other leaders recognized, it just seemed like you sign one treaty and then here comes the next one. The white man is always wanting more, they said. So, but it wasn't, and then the other thing that they were dealing with was just this encroachment, white men hunting buffalo that belonged to the Indians, and establishing towns on land that had been, agreed to by treaty to American Indians. And you mentioned the gold rush into the Black Hills, as well as the gold rush to the Montana gold fields. It brought people onto Lakota lands, and it just wasn't a matter of people crossing those lands, whether it was the Bozeman Cutoff or the Missouri River, but they're shooting game. They're, killing the sustenance, the life way of these people. And Sitting Bull really would have loved to have maintained that earlier balance I talked about, where you have some white traders. The white traders weren't trying to take their land. They were just trying to exchange, for their natural resources. And all along, even during the most violent times between the whites and the Lakotas, Sitting Bull said, "Can we just have some traders? We don't want people coming in onto our land, establishing forts, military posts, soldiers, settlers, gold miners." They were trying to maintain their homeland. And I should also mention that it wasn't just maintaining a homeland against the whites. Of course, they also were battling the Crows and other neighboring nations for those same resources, who also saw these resources shrinking at the same time. So it was a cascade of problems that were falling down while they were trying to live their traditional and maintain that buffalo culture.
Scott here. We're going to have a very short word from our sponsors. First, I want to give a shout out to all the great shows on the Parthenon Podcast Network, including History of the Papacy. You can find this and many other great shows at ParthenonPodcast.com. Before we focus on the Battle of Little Bighorn, I want to focus on an attribute that Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse shared, and that was being prophetic. They both had visions throughout their life. Sitting Bull, in particular, had a vision in regards to the outcome of the Battle of Little Bighorn that many people commented on, and I'm sure increased his standing among many people as a holy man. Could you describe this, the visions that the two of them had in their lives, and what do you make of this?
Yes, one of the things about these visions, and I really don't question them. I don't think it's my place to question them. If Sitting Bull said he had a vision or that an eagle talked to him, I don't question that. You know, Luther Standing Bear, who's a great cultural intermediary, he wrote a couple of books. He went to the Carlisle Indian School and learned to speak and write in English. And he said that, you know, many whites scoffed at such things, these visions of Crazy Horse and other individuals and Sitting Bull. But he said that, you know, the Lakotas were closer to nature and the white man just wasn't part of that world. Visions were a very integral part of Lakota life and of a Lakota man's or young man's journey to adulthood. So, and some were imbued or blessed with more visions than others, and especially holy men. I mean, they were known for their visions. They helped interpret visions for others. In fact, when Crazy Horse had a vision, it usually fell to his holy man named Hornships to interpret that vision and to guide Crazy Horse and to follow what Walking Tonka or perhaps other spirits might want that was obtained through that vision. Sitting Bull really was quite a seer into the future. And there are so many stories about the things that he saw that were told by, you know, different accounts. I use lots of accounts by American Indians that were taken in the late 20s and 30s who knew Sitting Bull, especially his nephews, White Bull and One Bull. They said one vision, Sitting Bull was bringing a war party. He'd led a war party out from the village and they'd been gone for several days. And on the way back, they had stopped and there was this, in a tree, there was this blue speckled bird that was singing. And Sitting Bull, who often spoke to the birds or at least understood them, said the bird told him that the people in the village were in mourning. They were in tears because a rumor had arrived that the war party had been wiped out. And when they got to the village, sure enough, everybody was surprised because they had heard that they were not going to be returning, had been killed. And Sitting Bull had foretold this. He could find lost things for people. Another vision he had, which was a very foreboding vision, a meadowlark told him that he would be killed by his own people. So perhaps the greatest, though, vision, the one that most people know about, is before the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And in a Sundance village on Rosebud Creek, he stared at the sun. He'd been doing this for a very long time. Before he did this, pieces of flesh had been, you know, dozens of pieces of flesh had been cut from both of his arms. And he had also fasted before doing this Sundance. And so he's very weak. So he's dancing with blood streaming down his arms. He's staring below the sun and he sees lots and lots of soldiers, like many, many grasshoppers, and they're coming with heads down, which was interpreted as these men are dead or are going to be killed. He also saw many warriors with heads down. So there were going to be warriors killed as well. But this was interpreted that there would be a great battle, but it would be a great victory for the Lakotas. And a few days later, they have the Battle of the Little Bighorn, which is indeed a great victory for the Lakotas. But there's another part of the vision that not many people know about. And Sitting Bull was instructed to tell his people not to plunder the Long Knives, not to take the possessions from them. If they take the possessions, their people would be doomed.
Well, getting to the battle itself, it seems like it's inevitable with U.S. government policy. There's an expedition that Custer goes on in 1874 to explore the Black Hills for gold and determine a location for a military fort. This is in response to the Black Hills gold rush. And Sitting Bull's Custer's expedition is an attack then, but at this point, the U.S. government is under incredible pressure to open the Black Hills to mining and settlement. I'm sure there are those in Washington who would want to maintain this sort of uneasy status quo in the Dakota territories, but it's not really possible. So Grant orders Sioux bands outside the Great Sioux Reservation to move on to reservations. He knows that not everyone is going to comply, so he calls those who don't comply hostile, which allows the military to pursue Sitting Bull and other Lakota bands as being hostile. So it just seems inevitable at this point that the government sort of expecting that there's going to be military confrontation and it will allow settlers to go in and, you know, a lot of the inevitable to happen. But could you describe the Battle of the Little Bighorn in light of these two men and other details that you think the audience should know? This is a well-worn story, but, you know, you are approaching this from a specific angle and it's worth seeing it from there.
Sure. Yeah, I would preface it by saying that this whole campaign of 1876 is brought about because U.S. officials did meet with Lakotas and they really wanted to them again to sign another treaty. They were going to try to buy the Black Hills. I mean, there were all kinds of miners in the hills at that time. And, you know, the government, in their eyes, they, you know, like you said, it was kind of foregone. You know, these people, we're not going to force them out. We're not going to spend resources with the army continuing to run miners out of the Black Hills. So we're going to buy the Black Hills from Lakotas. And once these anti-treaty bands, I call them the anti-treaty bands under Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull, because they're fiercely opposed. Their leaders are fiercely opposed to signing away any land. They're not going to sign away anything. Red Cloud was willing to sign it away. Spotted Tail was willing to sign it away. Lots of other leaders were willing to sign it away, but not Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull. So Grant's ultimatum or orders that you mentioned were a result of the fact that, you know, the anti-treaty bands were throwing a wrench into his plans. He wanted those lands. He wanted them signed over. So he thought by kind of fomenting this war, this would force everyone into line and they could eventually, you know, get that treaty and take away the Black Hills from the Lakotas. So the Battle of Bighorn is a result of this three-pronged strategy. And again, as you've mentioned, it's been talked about many times. You know, General Crook had a column. He was coming up through Wyoming. Custer had a column. And then General Terry and Gibbon would have another column. And the idea was they were going to converge in the Little Bighorn country. The person that ends up finding this massive village, of course, is Custer with his regiment of about, I don't know, something like 566 men and also Indian auxiliaries, scouts, and what have you. And it was a matter of both good timing and bad timing for both the Lakotas and Custer. At this time, in the summer of 1876, not only did you have the anti-treaty bands and the followers of Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, Two Moons of the Cheyennes that were gathered, but often at this time in the summers, you had the reservation Indians who would leave to visit their relatives out on the plains and to get some meat. I mean, beef wasn't always the best on the reservation and rations might be short. And this was a time for some of these reservation Indians to go out, visit family, attend the Sundance. And so this particular village had really grown quite a bit to where actual fighting men component for the Lakotas, sometimes it's, you know, between 1,000 and 1,500 warriors. As far as Custer's concerned, you know, he wants to find this village and attack, and he had the good timing to find the village where they were expected, but he, not knowing the vast size of the village and not listening to some of his Indian scouts, the Arickaras and Crows, decides to attack because he feels that, for good reason, that he's been discovered. And in most cases, when the Plains tribes discover that there's a military column hot on your trail, they scatter or disperse. So he decides to attack immediately, but he divides his regiment into three battalions. He takes five companies himself, about 200 men, and he sends another battalion under Major Reno, the second in command, to directly attack the village. And then a third column or third battalion, he sends off in another direction with kind of vague orders. This was under Captain Benteen, and he thought, you know, this is kind of like punishment. You know, why am I going off in this direction? There's obviously no Indians over here. We really don't know what Custer was thinking where he sent Benteen. And then there was a company with the pack train. which had all the ammunition. So he's dividing his regiment in the face of a superior force, and it comes back to bite him because the Indians can fight piecemeal this regiment. They quickly stop Major Reno's battalion and force a retreat to what's today is Reno Hill, which with vast casualties to the Long Knives. And after Reno's on top of the hill, then they go after Custer, who apparently is going towards the head of the village, which turns out to be much larger and longer along the valley than he had ever imagined. In fact, he tells his troopers, there's plenty of Indians down there for all of us, and indeed there were. But his idea might have been to capture non-combatants. There were women and children that were fleeing downstream to the north. And he thought perhaps by capturing these non-combatants, he could hold off the enemy the Lakotas, like it happened at the Battle of the Washita, what also is referred to as the Washita Massacre. Once he had captured lots of women and children, the Cheyenne warriors were and Arapaho were afraid to fire on the troops. But Custer doesn't capture any non-combatants, and he hastily sends a note and several runners to retrieve the pack train and to call up Benteen, and they don't arrive, and Custer is annihilated. Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull are both participants in the battle itself, except for Sitting Bull. And again, this comes from his vision. Sitting Bull was told that he was not to partake in the fight itself. He could carry a weapon to defend himself, but he was not to ride with his men. And at this time, Sitting Bull's 45 years old. He's considered what's called an old man chief, and he's not really expected, it's not expected of him to be a warrior or to fight. So what Sitting Bull does during the battle is that he helps the women and children escape to safety. He also shouts encouragement to his men and to his nephew, and he tells them to brave up, but he isn't actually fighting. And this was really misunderstood at the time. They thought that Sitting Bull was out there leading charges, which he wasn't. Crazy Horse, on the other hand, is much younger, and he was leading his men. He was both in the fight against Reno in the valley, and then he played a particular role and a decisive role that led to Custer's demise. As Custer's units were collapsing and retreating, some of the reserve troops were stationed, and some of the survivors of other companies were along what's today known as Battle Ridge. It's a hogback. And Crazy Horse, at a particular moment, realized that, again, even with this weaponry, this was a typical tactic. It was called a brave run. If you could draw the fire of most of the troops, it still took them a little bit of time with these trapdoor Springfields. They're breech loaders, but they're single shot. It did take them some time to reload. And he picked a particular moment to ride alone on this brave run and charge directly over the hogback between the troops who all essentially were firing at Crazy Horse and emptying their weapons. And at that moment, as he passes through, this, of course, incites and emboldens all the warriors who see this incredible feat, and they all charge, and they annihilate those men on the hogback, and just a few survivors rush to Custer's group on what's known as Last Stand Hill. And then that's where Custer and his men are finished off. So, one of Crazy Horse's several glorious moments takes place on Hogback Ridge, on the hogback at Little Bighorn. And it is right up there with his moment as a decoy at the 100 in the hand.
It's worth looking at their stories at the end of this battle and the immediate aftermath. First, could you tell me what happens with Crazy Horse?
Yes. Yeah, so again, Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull, they aren't conducting campaigns against the white man. They're not traveling to white man cities or towns. They simply want to be left alone. And if they're going to be attacked, they're going to fight back. So they, Crazy Horse and his people, they leave, go to the Powder River country. And again, they're hoping that the white man is just going to leave them alone and not bother. They don't want to be bothered. And the same with Sitting Bull. He's in the Upper Missouri country. And again, he wants to be left alone. But the whites aren't going to leave him alone after the Battle of Little Bighorn. I mean, at that point, there's going to be, the public, the white public is clamoring for retribution, for retaliation, and to control the anti-treaty bands, to force them upon reservations. They are not going to allow them to live free. And more troops are sent into the field. And this time, these soldiers, whether it's Sheridan or Sherman, they're very smart. They know that the winter is when these Plains Indians are at their most vulnerable. Their horses need grass, forage, and it's difficult to get that in the wintertime, so the ponies are weak. And they're not going to let up. They're going to fight regardless of the weather, whether it's winter, spring, summer, or fall. They're going to go after these anti-treaty bands and to force their surrender. Sitting Bull takes an exit across what's known as the Holy Line, takes his people into Canada. At one time, shortly after a Little Bighorn, or let's say in the year 1877, there's like 800 lodges of Lakotas living in Canada. And it's a very difficult position for Sitting Bull, but he's unwilling to surrender to the United States. So, and when I say difficult, there are other tribes that are nations that are already in Canada, and they're competing for drastically shrinking buffalo herds. And the Canadian government isn't real happy about having Sitting Bull and his people there, but they're not going to force him out, but they're not going to give him handouts like they do to the nations that they have treaties with in Canada. So Sitting Bull's up there for about 4 years. As for Crazy Horse, Crazy Horse says that I just am not going to leave the land that belongs to me. He felt very strongly about this is our land. I'm not going to flee. I'm not going to go into exile. And in 1877, less than a year after Little Bighorn and after multiple encounters with white soldiers and fights throughout the winter and defections, his followers are leaving. They feel like they're just not willing to starve to death. And they have women and children to care for. And eventually, Crazy Horse is, as much as he is against surrendering and facing confinement on a reservation, he also has his people to care for, and he's finally willing to do what they wish, if they wish to surrender, to get fed, because they're truly starving. So in April and May, he makes a journey with his people to the Red Cloud Agency, which is in the very northern edge of Nebraska, and he officially surrenders with his people, about 900 individuals, about 200 warriors and headmen, the rest women and children, and agrees to live on the reservation. Although Crazy Horse feels, and this may be the case, that he was promised a reservation of his own, and that's a sticking point in his dealings with Indian agents and the military once he is at the Red Cloud Agency in 1877.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Which then is close to his end.
Exactly. The thing about Red Cloud and Spotted Tail, who is actually Crazy Horse's uncle, and Spotted Tail has his own agency a few miles away. But the problem for Crazy Horse is that he was well equipped to fight as a warrior. And I write this in my book. It was easy to recognize an enemy on the battlefield. It was not so easy to recognize an enemy at the agency, because there's all these intrigues and politics that are going on, and it's jockeying for position. And individuals who at one time were devout followers of Crazy Horse now are jockeying for position with the true rulers, the people in power, and that's the Indian agent and the military. Little Big Man is a perfect example. Little Big Man was a friend and a follower of Crazy Horse, but on the reservation, he changes his allegiances, as many do, and he has individuals who he thought were friends who are not friends, and it's hard for him to navigate this and to see around this, and besides the fact that he has his personality where he's very modest, he's shy, he doesn't like to speak, he hates council meetings, and it's very troubling, and he doesn't really see a way out, and rumors are being spread, and people who are jealous of him, and both Red Cloud and Spotted Tail were jealous of the status at Crazy Horse and the reverence that people had for Crazy Horse. And so there are those who should be his allies who are working against him, and they're telling lies. And this is what leads to the attempt to arrest Crazy Horse. There's this rumor that was a complete lie that Crazy Horse was going to get in a meeting with General Crook and kill him. And so now they order Crazy Horse to be arrested, based on a false rumor. And once Crazy Horse is brought in, again, he's told what ends up being lies, that he's just going to talk to the commander at Camp Robinson. He's actually going there to be arrested and put in jail. He's going to be shipped away. And he believes he's going to be talking to the commander until the moment that he realizes that this place where they're taking him has bars. It's a guardhouse. And he struggles. Little Big Man is right there with him and, now helping the Long Knives into confining him, into putting him in a prison. And Crazy Horse lashes out. He grabs his knives. He's striking around. There's a complete melee. And finally, one of the officers says, the phrase, kill the son of a bitch. And one of the guards bayonets Crazy Horse. And it sends, these bayonets are evil. They're very 18 inches long and have a nasty point and mortally wounds Crazy Horse. There's just so many people around, so many Lakotas. And it's interesting that not many people actually see the bayonet stab. They don't know what's happened. They just know that he's been wounded. And some tried to tell the story that, he wounded himself with the knife that he was slashing about with. But it comes very close to being a firefight when Crazy Horse is wounded, because he has his followers there. There's other Lakotas there. There's Indian policemen there. There's soldiers of the guard that are there. And with Crazy Horse on the ground, there's a doctor. Some of the interpreters ran off. So there's people there, white men that don't speak Lakota. And one of the doctors, Dr. McGillicuddy, he's trying to take him into a room where he can treat him. And they try to take him back in the guardhouse. And this of course, causes great, outrage and anger. And finally, they get an interpreter and they say, he's a chief. Don't take him to the guardhouse. So they take him to the adjutant's office and lay him on the floor. And it's a mortal wound. And after several hours' time, he succumbs, to that wound and is dead. One of his good friends, Touch the Cloud, he points to Sitting Bull after his death, and he says, Sitting Bull, there's his lodge, but he points to above, and he says, but he's above, he's with the Thunder Beings. That was Crazy Horse's very tragic and sad end.
Sitting Bull's life goes on much longer, and after he surrenders to U.S. authorities and then finds other ways to try to integrate in U.S. society, the Wild West show, and he's involved with the Ghost Dance movement. Could you describe what happens to him after the Battle of the Little Bighorn?
Yes. So Sitting Bull goes into exile. He flees into Canada. But after 4 years, and most of his followers have gone back across the Holy Line into the United States. So Sitting Bull and his people, he actually has, less like 187 followers that surrender with him in 1881. And he's a prisoner of war. So initially, he thought he was going to go to the Standing Rock Reservation, where a lot of his other Hunk Papas and other Lakotas were living. But they take him to Fort Randall, and he's treated as a prisoner of war there until finally, it's another chief actually wrote the authorities in Washington and said, why is Sitting Bull kept at Fort Randall? What has he done? So he is actually returned to the Standing Rock Reservation. He and his followers live along Grand River. And, Sitting Bull doesn't really, this is the problem for Sitting Bull and the problem for his Indian agent, James McLaughlin. Sitting Bull doesn't try to integrate himself. What Sitting Bull sees is all the efforts of the Indian agent and the U.S. government to completely eradicate his culture. In fact, it really is cultural genocide. They aren't trying to kill the Lakotas, but their belief is they need to wipe out all of their traditions and to civilize. That's the word they use. They need to civilize these Lakotas in order for them to survive and to endure. So they think the best thing for the Indian is to eliminate anything that smacks of tradition. So that means the Sundance, which is outlawed, any other religious practices, you know, of course, as a holy man, this is all, you know, mumbo jumbo to James McLaughlin, the Indian agent. He wants to basically cut Sitting Bull down to just an individual. And it's a harsh, harsh transition, if you want to call it that, for Sitting Bull, who led a nation. And now his agent is telling him, you're no better than any other Indian. You're just a regular man, and you don't deserve the respect of a chief. And it puts them at complete odds with one another. So, the Indian agent, and everybody's aware of this, in 1885, you know, Sitting Bull travels with the Buffalo Bill Wild West exhibition, and to great acclaim. And, you know, when Sitting Bull comes back, McLaughlin, the Indian agent, says, well, he's even worse than he was before because of all this attention he got. It's exactly what I was trying to work against. And I just should mention, though, that one of the reasons that Sitting Bull went with Buffalo Bill was a promise that he would get to meet with the President of the United States, the Great Father. Because Sitting Bull, I mean, part of being a chief is taking care of your people. And he wanted to express some things to the president. And he indeed was taken to see the president, but all he got was a handshake. And he was so upset about it. I mean, here I was going to try to fight for my people and get some concessions for them. We want a place where we can live alone and not be bothered. And all the president did was shake my hand, and he ushered me out. And his interpreter who went along said, well, you know, Sitting Bull, you have to understand, there's all kinds of white men. They come to Washington and they spend weeks waiting to meet the president. Some never get to meet him. And Sitting Bull's response was, white men are damn fools. So it was a huge letdown. So this the whole Wild West thing was not something for Sitting Bull, you know, to get well treated or to feel pampered. He actually had a motive, you know, for going east. He wanted to see the president. Well, when Sitting Bull returns to the reservation, things are really no better between him and the agent. And they're really at odds because Sitting Bull, you know, he is going to live a traditional life. Now, he does have a cabin. He does have livestock. He's actually doing some of the things that the agent wanted for his people. But he's not what McLaughlin calls a progressive. He's a traditionalist, which is a bad, bad thing, the traditionalist, because he wants to wipe out these traditions. And then all of a sudden, something comes along that gives hope to some of the Lakotas, and that's the ghost dance religion. This ghost dance religion, the idea was if you continue to dance this dance in a certain way and to wear the ghost dance shirts or robes that they're sometimes called, that eventually the white men would go away, the buffalo return, and the life that they enjoyed would return. And also some of the people that they had, the lives that had been lost, some of these people would come back as well. But it would be a world without the white man. In fact, even when some versions of the ghost dance said a great chasm would develop in the earth and the white men would all be on one side and the Lakotas would be on another. It gave them hope. And especially because they were also starving, the traditionalists were sometimes denied the same amount of rations that the quote progressives were given. I mean, if you did what the Indian agent said, you know, you were friends. But if you bucked, you know, the policies of the Indian agent, you weren't friends. You were traditionalist. And so this ghost dance religion gave them hope and of returning to a life that they all sorely missed, this life of freedom, because they were not free on the reservation. They had to do essentially what they were told. Now, Sitting Bull doesn't partake of the ghost dance. He doesn't dance the dance. But as a holy man, he helps them prepare for the dance. He's not going to discourage it. He's going to allow his followers again because it gives them hope. It also gives him a little bit of status. You know, he's able to maintain this status as a leader by supporting the dancers and the ghost dance. But, you know, McLaughlin is not going to allow this to continue. The Indian agent is a very controlling. He's also very petty. He's also jealous of the influence that Sitting Bull has. And there's worries that Sitting Bull, and again, rumors that he's going to leave Standing Rock. And indeed, he was planning to leave. He was going to go to Pine Ridge because apparently that's where the Messiah was going to appear. And he wanted to investigate that for himself. In fact, you know, Sitting Bull even, he told McLaughlin, he said, let's go meet this guy, the Wovoka. Let's go meet him in person and find out, you know, if it's true, it's true. If it's not, it's not. And we can abide by the results. But McLaughlin wasn't going to have anything to do with it. When he hears that Sitting Bull is preparing to leave, you know, he works with the military to arrest him. And McLaughlin wants his Indian policemen to be involved, even though some of the Indian police are bitter enemies of Sitting Bull. And much like the attempted arrest of Crazy Horse, the attempted arrest of Sitting Bull goes wrong in every way it can go wrong. And Sitting Bull is essentially murdered like Crazy Horse is essentially murdered on December 15th, 1890. And he is indeed killed by fellow Lakotas, like his metal art told him he was going to be killed by his own people.
It's worth looking at the legacy of these two, and we have nearly a century and a half. There have been a number of interpretations. Maybe an older one that's likely antiquated in most places is that the intransigence of Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull led to a worse outcome for their people than it could have been if they would have dealt with the coming U.S. government more diplomatically. They could have secured better rights and privileges for their people. The perhaps a different take, more modern, is that they were placed in an impossible situation with an overwhelmingly technologically superior enemy, and they did their best to deal with what they could, but no one could have really navigated what they were dealing with successfully. And perhaps the most positive interpretation is that because of their heroic efforts to secure their rights for their people, they preserved culture in a way that would not have been preserved if they would not have held on to it so strongly. So what does exist today of American Indian culture is due to leaders like them. What is your take on their legacy?
Well, I would agree more closely with the third scenario that you describe. I do think that they serve as inspiration to all Americans today, not just American Indians, but in their resistance, in their fight for essentially freedom, for free will. And I don't look at the past and see what happened to the Lakotas in a way that was a fatalistic view or that it was inevitable. I think that in the dealings with the Indian nations on the plains, that the Euro-Americans had an obligation to be better. And the reason I say that is that the Euro-Americans always held themselves up as better. They claimed to be civilized. And yet in their dealings with the American Indians, they weren't civilized at all. I mean, the way that the Indian agents and the U.S. government lied to, stole, and took from Lakotas wasn't civilized. The way that the U.S. Army attacked Indian villages, killing and maiming women and children, wasn't civilized. The deaths of Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull weren't civilized, and these were all done by people who claimed to be better. So I hold the U.S. government and the Euro-Americans who encroached on Lakota lands as responsible for the tragic outcome that Lakotas are still experiencing to this day. You know, the Lakotas live on the places where they live are some of the poorest places in the country. But one of the legacies also of that time is the Fort Laramie Treaty. And I think it's a little ironic. I mean, Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, of course, were deathly opposed to signing treaties. But that treaty that was signed in 1868 had a provision that said that any land cessions that were given must be approved by 3/4 of the male population of the Lakotas. And that never happened. And so to this day, those lands of the Black Hills are contested because the U.S. Supreme Court, in a landmark case, agreed that the government never got those signatures, and they awarded a large monetary settlement that still sits apparently in the coffers of the Indian Bureau, and it's estimated at around $2 billion. And to get back to Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull, the Lakotas have refused that money. They resist. They say if we take the money, then all our claims would be gone. So they continue to be inspired by Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull. And the way in the book, as the one Lakota explained it, he said, "We won the battle against Custer, but the war continues." And that's what Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse were all about. Not necessarily about war, but for fighting and standing up for their freedom and for their homeland and for their culture. And I think that is the lasting legacy of those two great leaders.
Well, what you described is a great job connecting the period of their lives to contemporary events. And there's much more that we couldn't get to into this discussion. For listeners who are interested, the name of Mark's book is The Earth is All That Lasts, Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, and the Last Stand of the Great Sioux Nation. Mark, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Scott. I really like talking about these amazing individuals, and I appreciate you taking the time to explore that subject.
All right, that is it for today. If you would like to see show notes for this episode, along with all my others, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that I'm a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second way is to join our membership program, and if you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.